Anyway, okay, it's 11 o'clock, so all our nice chatter that I initiated is my fault. I'm going to have to call to an end.
I'll take some of the blame too, Rabbi Kalman.
I'm gonna mute everybody. You'll put in the chat, and that towards the end of the talk, Rabbi Lecture will take a look at it. I'm just going to be muted. Wait, give me 1 second. Okay. Rabbi, you should be able to speak, I hope. No, it didn't work. Give me a second. Now,
I muted myself.
Okay. Now it's 11. It's still 11. We're not even late. So we managed to squeeze that in, all that nice talk. Okay. Thank you. Bakashat's welcome. A pleasure for the fourth of our last series with Rabbi Dr. Lakshin. And we look forward to learning with him next week in Sefer Shmon. And beyond that, we'll see in the fall. Hopefully, we'll have more opportunities to learn together. And Bakashat, Tamei HaMitzvot. Here we go.
Right. You know, there are... It's hard to say this, but some good things have come out of Corona. The number of people, you know, who are able to learn Torah online around the world, these are really you know, seeing the people who are taking advantage of the time that they have now for not good reasons. They have time and they're using it for studying of Torah. You know, I had been thinking that since we read Parshat Chukat here in Israel last Shabbat, and you'll be reading it, those of you who are in Chutz La'aretz, will be reading it this coming Shabbat, that it would probably be appropriate for me to end this series of lectures with explaining finally the secret of the Parah Aduma, of the red heifer, but I decided not to do that. If anybody's looking for something good that has been written about the Parah Aduma, I'll just mention that in Jacob Milgram's book on the Book of Numbers, part of the series of the Jewish Publication Society of commentaries on the books of the Chumash, there's an essay about the Parah Aduma that I think is one of the best things that I've seen in an attempt to explain the paradox of the fact that the Parah Aduma removes tum'ah, removes impurity, but also causes the people who are involved with it to become impure. But that's so that's what we're not going to do today. When I thought about what we will do today for the final session, I thought of three different topics that I wanted to do. And I've prepared sources about those three different topics. And I'm guessing that I'll only manage to get to two of them, but we'll see. We'll see how fast we go. So I'm going to share my screen with you, and we'll get started on our text. So the Torah explains that many of the mitzvot are there. There's a general explanation of what the purpose of many mitzvot is. You shall not copy the Kemase Eretz Mitzrayim Asher Yeshavtem Ba Lo Ta'asu, Kemase Eretz Kanan Asher Ani Mevi Etchem Shama Lo Ta'asu, Uvechukotehem Lo Telechu. You shouldn't copy the practices of the Egyptians where you used to live. You shouldn't copy the practices of the Canaanites where you are going to be living, and you shouldn't follow their laws. Those of you who know the halachic literature know that this principle, b'chukotehem lo telechu, turned into a mitzvah. In all the books that count the mitzvot, there is a separate mitzvah called u'b'chukotehem lo telechu. Don't follow the laws. Don't follow the practices. In other words, the Torah is saying that we should not follow what other cultures are doing. Et mishpatai ta'asu, God says, et mishpatai ta'asu, v'et chukotai tishmeru lalechet bahem, ani Hashem Elokechem, u'shmartem et chukotai v'et mishpatai asher yaseh otam ha'atam v'chai bahem. Live by these laws. These laws will be a source of life to you. You're supposed to reject the laws of the people around you. So this is a principle. And you can argue, this isn't the only passage in the Torah that says this. There are a number of passages in the Torah that have this same message, and you can argue, and I think it's reasonable to argue, that this is not just another specific mitzvah of ubechukotehem lo telechu, if not following chukot hagoyim. But this is like an explanation of what the Torah is trying to do. It's a general statement about ta'amei ha-mitzvot that, put simply, our forefathers were, our ancestors were loners in a world of people who lived a life of avodah zarah, a world of idolatry, and the Torah is saying, here's a set of laws to follow that will wean you away from idolatry and that will bring you closer to God's law. So this is the general statement, and I'm sure that some of you know already, and those of you who don't know will see very soon. The Rambam takes this principle and he runs with it. In the third part of the Guide of the Perplexed, where he gets into a discussion, we've seen already a couple of texts from the third part of the Guide of the Perplexed, where Rambam is talking about his understanding of Ta'amei HaMitzvot. But what we haven't seen until now is Rambam's explanation that many mitzvot are to be understood in terms of being a polemic against Avodah Zarah, an argument against Avodah Zarah, that there was a world of Avodah Zarah, and the purpose of the Torah is to try to wean us away from Avodah Zarah. Now, we know that from the fact that the Torah keeps repeating the prohibition of Avodah Zarah. I used to sometimes say to my university students that, you know, that things that are a problem get repeated in the Torah many times, like the sur on Avodah Zarah. You know, the rules of incest aren't repeated many times in the Torah because presumably this wasn't a big problem in this society. And, you know, the rules of what you shouldn't eat, but there's actually, you know, the Rishonim have a difficulty with the fact that actually it doesn't say anywhere in the Torah that you're not allowed to eat human beings. And then the Rishonim try to explain why we know that it's forbidden to eat human beings. And I'm told that there was, they used to have at Yeshivat Har Etzion in the days when they had co-Rashi Yeshiva there, Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Amital, and they sometimes would give sichot together and the students would ask questions. I was told that Rav Lichtenstein said that according to his understanding of halacha, if you have a choice between eating human flesh and eating pig in order to stay alive for pikuach nefesh purposes, you would eat human flesh because there's a specific isser in the Torah of eating pork, and there isn't a specific isser. So we say, that we start with the less serious infractions, and then we move on to the more serious infractions. And I'm told, I wasn't there at the time, I think my son was the one who studied for a couple of years there. He said that Rav Amital said, Rav Lichtenstein, give me a break. What do you mean? What are you saying? Something like this. You know, the reason that it doesn't mention cannibalism in the Torah isn't because it's more kal, it's less serious. It's just Baruch Hashem, it's not a problem that we would assume that anybody would be tempted to be doing something like this, and so that's why it isn't mentioned. So the question is, do you take that formal halachic analysis, or do you think more of the idea behind it? Anyways, the Torah is, as it says here, trying to wean us away from Avodah Zarah. And what does Rambam do with this? He writes in the Guide of the Perplexed that he has done research about Avodah Zarah. My knowledge of the belief, practices, and worship of the Sabians has given me an insight into many of the divine precepts, many of the mitzvot, and has led me to know their reasons. I have studied Avodah Zarah The Sabians, the Sabians are a tribe who are mentioned in the Quran, who converted to Islam. But they were seen in the Quran as being a group of people who practiced Avodah Zarah, practiced idolatry like they used to in antiquity. And people wrote books about the Sabians, about what they used to do before they became Muslims. And there's a kind of assumption here that I think that many historians today would not accept, but the kind of assumption here is that there has been a kind of continued practice of Avodah Zarah in the same way over the years. And when we read the books about the Sabians, so when we understand how Avodah Zarah worked in the ancient world also. So I've done as much study, Rambam says, I've done as much study. He's going to give us the reading list in a second. He's going to give you the bibliography, all the books that he read in order to figure out how Avodah Zarah worked in the ancient world. You will agree, he says in the third line here, after I give the reason of commandments, which are seemingly purposeless, you'll see, I'm going to tell you what they used to do, the Ovdei Avodah Zarah used to do, those who worshipped idols in the ancient world used to do. And when you hear that, then you'll say, so that's why the Torah said not to do X or not to do Y, because it was a polemic against what was going on in this ancient world. I will mention to you the works from which you may learn all that I know of the religion and the opinions of the Sabians. And he's giving us his reading list so that we too can read these books. The great book on this subject is the book On the Nabataean Agriculture, translated by Ibn Washiya. The book is full of the absurdities of idolatrous people. Rambam relied on this book considerably, and he quotes it often. The standard position of scholars today is that this is not an ancient book as Rambam thought it was, and that it was only written a few years before Rambam's time. But Rambam thought that he had a book. Some scholars say that some things in this book on the Nabataean agriculture might be preserving old traditions of how people used to worship Avodah Zarah. The great book on the subject is On the Nabataean Agriculture. The book is full of the absurdities of idolatrous people. And here we have the ruse of Rambam. I think I mentioned this before in a previous session, that Rambam writes in the introduction to the Guide of the Perplexed that he's writing this book for one student who is perplexed, who has been studying philosophy and has been studying Torah and sees the conflict between these. And then he says, it's by no means necessary to point this out to men like you, Yosef, the intended audience of this book. You have acquired sufficient knowledge to keep your mind free from the absurdities of the Kazdim, the Chaldeans, and the Sabians, who are bare of every true science. I know that maybe you don't need to be weaned away from Avodah Zarah, but I wish to exhort you that you should caution others, for ordinary people are very much inclined to believe these fables. But Rambam says there is an attraction of Avodah Zarah. There are many people who are attracted to Avodah Zarah, and so that's why we need various mitzvot to keep us away from the absurdities of Avodah Zarah. To the same class of books, here's the continued reading list here. We count the book Istimachus, attributed to Aristotle, who can by no means have been its author. Rambam has too much respect for Aristotle. He says this book that's filled with all this narishkeit, with all this foolishness of Avodah Zarah, couldn't have been written by Aristotle. Also the books on talismans, such as the book of Tomtom, the book of Al-Sarb, the book on the degrees of the sphere and the constellations rising with each degree, a book on talismans attributed to Aristotle, a book ascribed to Hermes, a book of Sabian Ishaq in defense of the Sabian religion, and his large work on Sabian customs, details of their religion, ceremonies, festivals, offerings, prayers, and other things relating to their faith. Scholars who are more expert in this than I am have said that most of these books are lost. Some of them, we have manuscripts of some of them, but they aren't easily available these days. Most of these works are lost, but these are works that Rambam considered authoritative for understanding what was going on in the world of Avodah Zarah. All these books books, which I have mentioned, are works on idolatry translated into Arabic. And so Rambam is admitting to us that the only books that he was able to read on the subject were the ones that were translated into Arabic. There is no doubt that they form a very small portion in comparison to that which has not been translated. I guess there are a lot of other books that nobody bothered to translate into Arabic yet, and that which is no longer extant, but has been lost in the course of time, and all sorts of books got lost. I did a lot of research, he's saying, but I know that my research can't cover everything, and we'll see how this plays itself out when Rambam comes to giving some Ta'amei Mitzvot coming up now. But those works which are at present extant include most of the opinions of the Sabians and their practices, which are to some degree still in vogue in the world. That's Rambam's point here. Sabianism of Odah Zarah is not finished from the world. And certainly in Rambam's day, there were still people who would be considered to be idolaters. Islam, Christianity, and Judaism were not the only religions in the world that Rambam knew. They were the major religions there, but there were other religions. And so he says that these problems still continue to exist today. And now he gives a couple of examples. We've explained in our large work, the Mishneh Torah, his code of law, that it is prohibited to round the corners of the head and to mar the corners of the beard because it was the custom of idolatrous priests. So why are you not allowed to cut off this part of the hair on the peyot and parts of the beard? You're not allowed to use a straight edge on them. He said, because this is what idolatrous priests used to do. And so that's why we have a rule against this. For the same reason, the wearing of garments made of linen and wool is prohibited. And that's why shatnez is prohibited too. Because the heathen priests, Rambam says he found this in one of these books about Avodah Zarah, the heathen priests adorned themselves with garments containing vegetable and animal material while they held in their hand a seal made of a mineral. So this was a form of Avodah Zarah, a ceremony where the priest would have clothing that consists partially of animal material and partially of plant material. And they were also holding, so we've got animal, vegetable, and mineral all together. He found evidence of a ceremony. And he said, and that's why the Torah said, in order to keep us away from this kind of Avodah Zarah, that's why the Torah said that we should not wear shatnez. Remember, we saw last week Rashbam's explanation of why we shouldn't wear shatnez, keeping the different species separate from each other. But Rambam says it's all related to Avodah Zarah. This you find written in their books. You know, I gave you the reading list. You can look it up and you will see that this is what they used to do. The same is also the reason of the precept of the mitzvah, a woman shall not wear that which pertains to a man. Why a woman is not allowed to wear man's clothing and why a man is not allowed to wear a woman's clothing. You will find it in the book Tom Tom that a male person should wear colored women's clothing when he stands before Venus, and a female, when she stands before Mars, should wear a buckler and other armor. Amazing. Rambam seems to know that men are from Mars and women are from Venus. And he says, if a man has to, these Ovdei, or at least the Ovdei Avodah Zarah that Rambam has read, think that men are from Mars and women are from Venus. And that's why if a man has to have contact with Venus, then he should wear women's clothing. And if a woman has to have contact with Mars, then she should wear men's clothing. Of course, Mars and Venus were in the mythology system, they were married to each other. Mars was the god of war, and Venus, and it was male, and Venus was the female god of love. Some of you might know that the name Martin, it comes from Mars, and Martin means warlike, And those of you who know me well know that that's an appropriate name for me, warlike Lakshan. So Rambam says, this is the reason why a man might put on women's clothing and why a woman might put on men's clothing, because of this Avodah Zarah idea that sometimes a man might find himself under the influence of Venus, and it would be useful for him to be wearing women's clothing so that maybe to fool Venus into thinking that he's a woman. I don't know what precisely the logic of the Avodah Zarah here is. And then he says, I think that this precept has also another reason, namely that the interchange of dress creates lust and leads to immorality. This just from a logical perspective, this cross-dressing, I don't think is a good idea if we're trying to have a society that observes rules of proper sexual conduct. But Rambam is confident that he has found reasons to make sense of various mitzvot that seemed, as he said earlier, that seemed to you purposeless, but they're not purposeless because they are a polemic against Avodah Zarah. Now, of course, I see all sorts of comments coming on the chat. I'm not going to look at them till later, but I bet you that somebody has said on the chat, maybe I'm wrong, but I bet you that somebody has said on the chat, well and good that these things argue against this kind of Avodah Zarah, but what happens to us now when we don't have this problem of these forms of Avodah Zarah anymore? Does this really help me observe the mitzvah when you say to somebody, well, the reason that the Torah gave this mitzvah is to try to keep you away from this form of Avodah Zarah, and these forms of Avodah Zarah no longer exist in our world. That's a big problem with Rambam's theory of mitzvot here in the Guide of the Perplexed. And I guess I have two things that I could suggest on that subject. First of all, Rambam thinks, as we saw in this text, that he thinks that Avodah Zarah has not left our world. And certainly Avodah Zarah has not entirely left our world either in the 21st century. And so that's part of what's going on here. He said to his student Yosef, I know that you're not going to be misled by all this Avodah Zarah stuff, but there still are people who are going to be misled by Avodah Zarah. And that's why we need these mitzvot to keep people away from these things. The other thing that you can say is that Rambam simply is looking, it's not so much that he's looking at a way to make us feel better. Oh, that's why I am observing the mitzvot. He's trying to deal with the claim that, you know, from a philosophical point of view, the mitzvot don't make any sense. And, you know, we saw last week the Christian claim that the mitzvot don't make any sense, that the details of the mitzvot don't make any sense, and so they have to be allegorized. And Rambam's dealing with a different version of that same kind of argument. He's dealing with people who say, you know, philosophically speaking, what's the problem of wearing a shirt that's made out of wool and linen together? And he comes up with a historicized explanation that at a particular time in history, it made perfect sense to have a mitzvah of this nature. And he feels that he has solved the intellectual problem of figuring out why the Torah said something like this, even if this hasn't helped you as the Jew who wishes to find a good rationale for your observing this mitzvah. At least you won't think that the Torah is meaningless. That's his goal here, that you shouldn't think that the Torah is meaningless. It does have a real meaning, and I can find you, for almost every mitzvah that you think is purposeless, I can find you how it is polemicizing against something in Avodah Zarah. And some of you will know, and others will hear from me now, that among many modern Bible scholars who are traditional Bible scholars, this approach has persisted. And my teacher, Professor Nachum Sarna, Zichrono Livracha, really ran with this idea. Professor Sarna studied things about the ancient world that weren't available to Rambam to study, reading texts in Ugaritic and in Assyrian, and knowing really what was going on in the world surrounding the Torah, and arguing that much of what goes on in the Torah is a polemic against the world of Avodah Zarah. And so this kind of approach has lived on among some of the more traditional modern Bible scholars. One of Rambam's explanation, I've always liked this text here in Rambam. Rambam writes about trying to explain here in his list of trying to explain for all of the mitzvot of the Torah what the reasons for them are. He gets to basar b'chalav, meat boiled in milk. So first of all, he says, meat boiled in milk is undoubtedly gross food. Yuck. Who would want to eat something like that? So you know, the fact that I can totally understand why it is outlawed. And it makes you overfull. It's Rambam, the physician, speaking, saying this is, it's not good for the digestion to eat something like this. But I think that most probably it is also prohibited because it is somehow connected with idolatry, forming perhaps part of the service or being used on some festival of the heathen. You know, just when I think about it, says Rambam, this probably also is a polemic against the Lo Tevashel Gadi B'Chalev Imo, is probably also a polemic against something that's going on in the world of Avodah Zarah. And he writes, I find a support for this view in the circumstance that the Torah mentions the prohibition twice after the commandment given concerning the festivals. Shalosh pa'amim bashana yera'e kol zuchurcha et p'nei Hashem Elokecha. And it says further, Reshit Bikurei Admatcha Tavi Beit Hashem Elokecha. So two out of the three times that it says in the Torah, Lo Tevashel Gadi B'Chalev Imo, it begins by saying, you should come to the temple of the Lord your God, and you should bring your first fruit. And then it says, Lo Tevashel Gadi B'Chalev Imo, which Rambam understands as meaning, but don't boil a kid in its mother's milk when you do this. And so Rambam is just kind of, he says, from the context of this verse, it seems to me that there must have been a ceremony that went on among the idolaters where they used to boil a kid in its mother's milk. And the Torah says that you too should have a festival for the Lord your God, and you too should bring the first fruits to the temple of the Lord your God. But when you do that, Lo Tevashel Gadi B'Chalev Imo, don't boil a kid in its mother's milk. As if to say, when you come before me on your festivals, do not seethe your food in the manner of as the heathen used to do. This I consider, just Rambam as a text reader says, this must be the best reason for the prohibition. But as far as I have seen the books on Sabian rites, nothing is mentioned of this custom. That I'm sorry, I've done my research, and I can't find what it was in the world of Avodah Zarah that the Bible was polemicizing against. But he says, just from the context that it says, come to the temple, Reshit Bikurei Admatcha, bring your first fruits. How many years after Rambam, the end of the 12th century till the middle of the 20th century, almost 800 years later, Umberto Casuto, Harav Moshe David Casuto, in his book, The Goddess Anat, found a Ugaritic text. Ugaritic looks an awful lot like Hebrew. Nobody knows how to pronounce Ugaritic. Ugaritic was a language that was spoken in an area north of Eretz Yisrael, near the Syria-Lebanon area of Latakia today. It's a language that's extremely similar to Hebrew, and that no one has spoken for 3,500 years, and we have no idea how to pronounce it, because like Hebrew, it is it's written only with consonants. And if those of you who can follow the Hebrew, you can see on the left-hand side here that, that they found in Ugarit a text that says something like, Tabach Gad Bechalav, slaughter a Gedi, a baby goat, Bechalav, Ananach Bechemat. And Ananach is a word that it's a synonym to Gedi. One of the things about Ugaritic is, just like biblical Hebrew poetry, Ugaritic poetry is also written in parallelism, and into the two sticks of a verse, you'll have two different nouns that more or less mean the same as each other. So you should slaughter a gedi in milk, and you should slaughter an ananach in chem'ah, in butter. And Kasuto writes, I'll read the English translation here, this text apparently describes a ritual in Ugarit intended to increase the fertility of the land. From here, we can understand the connection between the verses about first fruits and the prohibition of meat and milk. Bring the first fruits of your land to the house of the Lord your God, to express your gratitude for the bounty that he gave you, but be careful not to do what the Canaanites do. Accordingly, do not boil a kid in its mother's milk. Now, I just for honesty's sake, some modern scholars disagreed with Kasuto, and they said that he is misunderstanding this Ugaritic text, and I am no expert in Ugaritic, but I do know that Moshe David Kasuto was a great scholar of Bible, and he was an Orthodox rabbi, he was an interesting and trustworthy person as far as I know, and he claims that we can see, actually we're seeing that Rambam's sense as a reader of the biblical text, when he looked at it, that verse, Reshit Bikurei Admatcha Tavi Beit Hashem Elokecha Lo Tbashel Gedi B'Chalei Vimo, Rambam sensed there has to be a connection between the first part of the verse and the second part of the verse. And Kasuto claims that he found this connection in texts from Ugarit, which are written before the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, in this area of the world here in the western part of the Middle East. And the Torah is saying, when you go to the temple of the Lord your God, as Rambam said, it's saying, don't boil a kid in its mother's milk. I repeat that this might not help you feel better about performing an individual mitzvah, but that presumably was not Rambam's goal. Rambam's goal was that you should consider that the Torah is a sensible book that has a sensible agenda, that is opposing to a world where everybody was an Oved Avodah Zarah, when Avodah Zarah was everywhere, and when it was a big problem. That is topic number one of what I wanted to do today. I told you I had three topics set up, and I would probably only get to two. I think I'm only going to get to two. And I'm going to go to topic number two now, which is entirely unconnected to this. But I thought another important topic to talk about when we deal with Ta'amei HaMitzvot. And I thought that I'd deal with a moral mitzvah. The mitzvah that appears in the book of Devarim, Lo tate mishpat ger yatom, v'lo tachbol beged almana. You shouldn't subvert the rights of the stranger or the orphan. You shouldn't take a widow's garment as collateral. And we have another verse in that same chapter that says that if somebody has borrowed money from you and that person is a needy person, you shouldn't go to sleep in his pledge. You must return the pledge to him at sundown that he may sleep in his clothing and bless you. So there's some poor person has borrowed money from you, and he doesn't have anything to give you as collateral. And what he gives you is his pajamas. You have to come and return the pajamas to him every evening so that he will have something to sleep in every evening. This is an interesting discussion about why, what actually is served by taking a collateral and then giving back the collateral every night. Some people say that there's still a certain embarrassment for the debtor, that he has to wait every night for you to show up there to bring him his pajamas. And so there is a certain incentive for him to try to earn some money so that he can return to you the money that he owes. But okay, so that's the second rule. And the first one here is you're not allowed to take a widow's garment as collateral. So the Mishnah discusses these laws, and it says, "Hamoder chaveru lo yimashkenenu ala bebeitin lo ikanes lebeito lito mashkono machzir et hakar balayla v'et hamacharisha bayom." A creditor may exact collateral from a debtor only with the permission of a court. You can't just walk into the person's house and take over things if he or she hasn't paid you back. The creditor may not enter the debtor's house to take the collateral. The creditor has to give back the pillow at night and the plow during the day. He can take it, but he gives it back when it's needed. He can't take away something. If that which you received in collateral is something that's tzorach nefesh, it's something that's needed for life, then you have to give it back. Then we get to the widow. Collateral, the Mishnah says, may not be taken from a widow, whether she be rich or poor. As it states, do not take a widow's garment as a pledge. Okay, so the Mishnah is saying, you might think that the reason that you're not allowed to take a widow's garment as a pledge is because she is poor, and that's rachmanis on the poor person. They say, no, even if she is extremely wealthy, this is a rule that applies to all widows. That's what the Mishnah says. But then the Gemara says, the Gemara begins by quoting a braita. I'll read it in English to save time. The sages taught, one may not take collateral from a widow, whether poor or wealthy. This is the statement of Rabbi Yehuda. So what it said in the Mishnah is actually only the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda, that this rule applies to a widow, whether she is poor or whether she is wealthy. Rabbi Shimon says, with regard to a wealthy widow, one may take collateral from her. It's okay. You can take the fur coat of a wealthy widow as collateral if she wants to borrow money from you. But with regard to a poor widow, one may not take collateral from her. And why? Because you are obligated to return it to her. And since you will be entering every day to return the collateral to her, you will thereby give her a bad name among her neighbors. So if you're going to be coming, if you've taken some clothing of a poor widow, then you're going to be coming to that widow's house every day to be giving it back, because of that other rule in Dvarim chapter 24 that we saw before. And so what's Rabbi Shimon doing? He's looking to try to figure out what the reason is for the law. And so after quoting this braita, the Gemara says, Lameimra de Rabbi Yehuda lo darish tama dekra, Rabbi Shimon darish tama dekra. Is this to say that Rabbi Yehuda does not interpret the rationale behind the mitzvah in the verse and draw halakhic conclusions based on that interpretation, and Rabbi Shimon does? And then they go on to a discussion. Does this consistently happen all throughout the mitzvot of the Torah? But just looking at the text from the Gemara that we have in front of us, that does seem to be what's going on here, that Rabbi Yehuda says, look, it says a widow. I don't care whether she's poor. I don't care whether the Torah says, lo tachbol beget almana. So it's an almana, and I don't care whether she's poor or wealthy. And Rabbi Shimon says, the first time that I saw this braita, I was surprised, because that wasn't the reason that came to my mind when I thought, why did the Torah say you shouldn't take collateral from a widow because you'll have to be giving it back to her every evening. And when you give it back to her every evening, you're going to go to her house every evening and you're going to be causing people to talk about the fact that you're walking into the home of this widow every evening. Atam misiyah shem rab ishchenoteha. You're going to give her a bad name among her neighbors if you're doing this. Okay, but we might not have thought of that, but that's what Rabbi Shimon looks at this rule, and he said that must have been the idea behind it. So Rabbi Shimon understands that he has to try to figure out what the rule is behind this law. Then we look at Rambam's commentary on the Mishnah. Rambam says, again, I'll read it in English. Of course, the Hebrew is also a translation because Rambam wrote his commentary on the Mishnah in Judeo-Arabic. It is forbidden to take collateral from a widow because of suspicion that may arise when the creditor spends time at her home because of the collateral. Or perhaps this could lead to impropriety between them. So Rambam expands that it's not just we're worried about the chashash, what people are going to say. It also, we're worried about the impropriety. This creditor is going to be coming to her house frequently, and who knows what's going to happen with him visiting this widow all the time. Accordingly, the same rule applies to a poor or a wealthy widow, which seems it's like Rambam has combined the two things together here. It was Rabbi Yehuda who said poor or wealthy, and it was Rabbi Shimon who said shata mesia shem rab bishchenoteha. But Rambam has combined the two of them together, and so he paskins that you're not allowed to take collateral from any widow, and he thinks that any contact between the male creditor and this female widow debtor could either lead to impropriety or at least lead to a bad reputation for this widow. Okay, so Rambam is also, you know, he's trying to figure out what is the reason behind this mitzvah. But that's not the end of it. Rabbi Chaim David Halevi, the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, a wonderful man who wrote some wonderful books, a series of books called Aseilu Harav, writes about this. He writes, following the Rambam's logic that it's because of suspicion, there's no reason to distinguish between a widow and a divorcee and a single woman. So, wait a second, is this about a widow? Rav Chaim David Halevi says, well, if the concern is suspicion of this man creditor going to the home of this unattached woman, then it's not just a widow, then it's also a divorcee or a single woman who's living by herself. It should be forbidden to take collateral from any unattached woman. And Rav Chaim David Halevi, who had encyclopedic knowledge, writes, Rabbi Shmuel Ashkenazi, the author of a book called Makom Shmuel in the 17th century, lived in Altoona. Rabbi Shmuel Ashkenazi actually wrote precisely that. And he concluded, they spoke about the most common case for widows are the women most likely to be business women. But in fact, by law, it is forbidden to take collateral from a divorcee or from a single woman too. So why does it say widow? Oh, that's just the most common case where you are going to find a woman who's in the business world is a widow. And I happen to know that this is true, at least about medieval times. Many years ago, I had the first graduate student that I had at York University was a woman, maybe some of you know her, some of you Torontonians there, named Cheryl Tallon, who walked into my office 30, 35 years ago and said to me that she wanted to do graduate work about Jewish widows in the Middle Ages. And I said, Cheryl, did you say Jewish women in the Middle Ages? She said, no, Jewish widows in the Middle Ages. And I said to her, are we going to find enough material? And she said, yes, we are going to find. And we did. We found a ton of material. And I learned from working with Cheryl that the women who were most likely to have money in a Jewish community in the Middle Ages were widows who had collected their ketubah and who were running the business or something that their husband had left behind. And so what Rav Shmuel Ashkenazi writes here, that they are the most common case for widows to be the woman who is a businesswoman. So Rav Shmuel Ashkenazi is saying here, this law applies equally to all unattached women, and it's not about being a widow. Okay, so that's Rav Chaim David Halevi. Then we move on to the Sma. We're going back in history. The Sefer Meir Einayim, Rav Yehoshua Volk or Folk, a Kohen in the 16th, 17th century. And he writes, I'll read it in English again. The law specifically mentions a widow since she has no help and support, neither from a husband nor from a father since she left his authority. The same law would apply to a divorcee, but not to a single woman who is still under her father's authority. So if there's a single woman whose father is still alive, we would not say that this law applies according to the Sma, but we would apply it to a widow and to a divorcee. That the meaning of the law, what does widow mean? It means a woman who does not have the protection of a man. Now, in the 21st century, we like to believe, we all believe, that it is possible for a woman to do quite well in the world, even without the protection of a man. But in the 16th century, and certainly before, there was a general feeling that it's very difficult for a woman to have any kind of success without the protection of a man. And so Rav Yehoshua Falk is saying, so the law has to mean a woman who doesn't have the protection of a man. And so it would apply to a divorcee also, but it wouldn't apply to a single woman whose father is still alive. Then the Shach comes in, or of Shabtai Kohen. These are all commentators on the Shulchan Aruch or on the tour. And the Shach writes, the Sefer Meir Einayim ruled that the same law applies to a divorcee. The Tzarich Iyun, you know, the matter requires further thought. You have to think about it a little bit. And he says, the reason for the law is that the widow's heart, is broken and full of worry. Why does the Torah say, Lo tachbol beged almana? Because the almana has been through this terrible situation of the death of her husband, and she is fragile. And so you shouldn't hit her while she's down. And then he says, you can either agree or disagree with the Shach who says this. This reasoning does not apply to a divorcee. Hay tama lo shayach begrusha. That a grusha is not liba shavur v'doeg. I think many of us would disagree with the Shach, but everybody here is trying to figure out what is the reason for the mitzvah. Because the Torah just said, lo tachbol beged almana. In order to apply that law, we have to figure out what the reason is behind the mitzvah. So we found a whole variety, poor, wealthy, widows but not divorcees, widows and divorcees but not single women, widows and divorcees and single women. All of them are possible interpretation depending on how you understand the law. And of course, the first opinion in the Mishnah was just the opinion, you know, it's steht geschribt, it's written almana, so I don't care wealthy, poor, and I don't care about trying to expand this to a divorcee or expand it to a single person, and none of that. But you see that most of the poskim, even though the Gemara said, you know, there's this machloket, darshin and tama dekra, or lo darshinan tama dekra? Do we try to figure out what the reason is behind the mitzvah, or do we not try to figure out what the reason is behind the mitzvah? All these poskim feel, of course we have to try to figure out what the reason is behind the mitzvah in order to be able to apply it, in order to be able to decide, does it apply just to a widow, or does it also apply to a divorcee? Does it apply to a single woman? Does it apply to a rich widow? Then we get back to the kind of strict constructionist kind of approach that, you know, just what the text says. Rav Yonatan Eibschitz, writing in the Tumim, writes, we should add nothing to what the Torah forbade. Ein lanu lo sif davar al ma she'asra Torah, davka al mana shedimata alechya uvocha al shivra hikpida Torah. The Torah was concerned specifically about widows whose tears are on their cheeks and who cry all the time about their loss. So we have yet another understanding. This is also Tama Dekra. This is also trying to explain what the reason is for the Pasuk. And the reason is, according to Rav Yonatan Eibschitz, that widows are particularly fragile, and we should understand that. And the Torah said something about the fragility of widows, but this does not apply to other people. And then, just the kind of the final word on the subject, we'll give to Sefer HaChinuch, who says, the idea at the root of this mitzvah is that God has mercy on God's creatures. God wants to improve us by establishing in our hearts the attribute of mercy. God wanted us to be merciful, and that's why he told us, Lo tachbol beged almana. God commanded us to have mercy on widows whose hearts are broken and who constantly worry, and not to take collateral from them. And then he said, I figure this is a good line to finish off with. Behold, darkei ha-Torah noam, unativoteh ha-shalom. All the ways of the Torah are ways of pleasantness. All its paths are paths of peace. And the rabbis are constantly looking at these mitzvot in the Torah and trying to figure out what even the people who oppose ta'amei ha-mitzvot in theory, when it comes right down to it, they know that they have to look at the reason for the mitzvah. Otherwise, they're not going to be able to figure out where to apply it and how to expand it. And that's what we learn from ta'amei ha-mitzvot, from a mitzvah. Even from, in the first session, somebody said, well, there's the moral mitzvot, and that's not a problem for understanding ta'amei ha-mitzvot, but it's with the ritual ones that we have difficulty. Well, sometimes with the moral mitzvot also, it's not all that easy to figure out, okay, we know that there is an idea here. We know that there's a moral principle here, but it's not quite clear what the moral principle is. Okay, I'm going to stop sharing the screen, and I'm going to take a look at the chat. Back to the beginning. Happy Canada Days. Firefighters save people from fire smoke, but often suffer from it as well. Very true. Incest, not a problem except for Reuven and Amnon. Yes, you are absolutely right. Really human flesh? Yes, really human flesh. Jonathan writes, one of the books Maimonides used was a forgery, probably more than one, Jonathan, but yes, for sure. Okay. The Kohanim also wore shatnez. Yes, that is also a reasonable explanation in the Tamei Mitzvot game of trying to figure out why there is an Isur of shatnez, why it is forbidden. It was because the Kohanim wore shatnez. And some people argue that the fact, the general assumption is that tzitzit, that the garment of the tzitzit would be made from linen, and that the strings of the tzitzit would be made from wool, and that it was permissible for every Israelite who wears tzitzit to wear shatnez in one garment, becoming kind of like the Kohanim in that one garment, but to remind us, so this isn't a bad explanation of what chatnez is. The chatnez is the special kind of garment that is worn by the Kohanim. A very good point, Susan. Okay, a problem with Rambam's explanation. Rebir's prohibition is not only what uses the mitzvah when idolatry changes or dies out, as the Kastator, a very time-bound document, not prescriptive for the future, but only descriptive of the time it was given. Yes, that's the problem of all historicizing, that when you give a historical explanation, then people are tempted to say, okay, fine and good, but it doesn't apply to us anymore. I'll tell some of you, because some of you know B'nai Torah congregation in Toronto, and where I was a member for many years. The first time that they asked me to give a talk at B'nai Torah, I gave the talk. And afterwards, some of you will, Marlene here and other people here will know, Professor Sidney Eisen came up to me after the talk and he said, Marty, that was a really good talk. He said, but do you know what you did in that talk of yours? He said, you historicized. He said, Marty, did anybody tell you that this is an Orthodox shul? That in an Orthodox shul, you don't give a historicized explanation of saying that the text was reacting to a situation that existed in the time of the text. Well, Rambam historicized. Rambam was an Orthodox Jew, and Rambam historicized. So, you know, I had a good laugh with Professor Eisen, and I think I said to him, Rambam historicized, so I'm going to do it too. Venus was married to Vulcan, but had an affair with Mars. I didn't know that. Thank you very much, Ellen. Don't we have customs to fool Satan, like not proclaiming the new month before Tishrei, changing people's names to hide from the angel of death? Yes, we still have various customs that are trying to keep us away from concerns about Satan. Ethiopian Jews eat milk with chicken, but Rambam might still say that if you eat meat with milk, that's a very heavy. This Kasuto text, Reugaritic, is a good time to say chelev, i.e. fat, parallel to butter, that maybe it says chelev instead of halav. Good, interesting possibility. Thank you for that suggestion. Chicken is not a mammal, for sure. If widows were more often business people, what if the creditor was also a woman? Very good question. I think the assumption was that the creditor was going to be a man, but I assumed that it was a false assumption and that there were creditors who were women. Okay. Rambam was not an Orthodox Jew, says Ellen, just a Jew. True, the word Orthodox had not been invented yet, and so he was just a Poshetzer Yid, a very smart Poshetzer Yid, but he wasn't an Orthodox Jew. Thank you for that comment. But he wasn't Pashut either. Pardon me?
He wasn't Pashut either, the Rambam.
He wasn't Pashut either, that's right. Pashut in the sense of simply a Jew. It was wonderful seeing you all. Rabbi Kelman, do you want to give a pitch for the next series starting?
I just want to thank
Sunday?
You, really, for a wonderful series. Thank you again. It was your idea to do Tamei Mitzvot, and we'll go back to commentaries on the Bible. Really, thank you. I really found this last part on the Amanah very, very interesting, because it sounds like such a simple mitzvah. I know the Machlok of the Mar, you know, but to see it's such a, you know, the range and how it has halachic implications. It's not just a theoretical argument, and really want to thank you for the whole series, and we look forward. Dr. Lakshin will be back next Tuesday at 11 a.m., his regular time slot. However, this will be the second of our series of Tanakh. I think you all know about it by now. We'll be doing, please God, the 24 books of Tanakh over the summer. It's really a phenomenal group. I'm very, very proud of the 24 people. Last night we finished with Sefer Yecheskel was the last slot to to finish. Dr. Holzer from Yeshiva University, he's a professor of Bible at YU. I haven't met him yet, but that came through 929, recommended him. We just were online. So we finished all 24 books, and we'll be starting this Monday. David Silver, Rabbi David Silver, the founder of Trisha on Bereshit, and Rabbi Lakshin on Shmuel, and Alex Israel on Vayikra, Erica Brown on Bamibar, etc., going through the 24 books until we get to Divrei Hayamim and Menachem Liebtag on, please God, August the 31st. So over the summer, you can learn all of Tanakh. We'll take a one-day break on Tisha B'Av, and hopefully I'm in the middle of putting together, we do, those of you in Toronto know, we put together every year a Tisha B'Av program. We'll do it online this year. Maybe next year, hopefully do it in Yerushalayim in the Beit HaMikdash. That would be a lot better. Ula, maybe this is, what can I say? But anyways, I want to thank you all. Everybody be healthy, be well. And we look forward to seeing you our next online class. So it's actually Thursday morning. We don't have both of the series that Wednesday are finished. So there will Thursday morning, Ari Zivotofsky will be our next year, 11 a.m. And any comments or suggestions and criticisms, or please send my way any ideas you have, any suggestions for speakers. Some of our speakers have come actually from of our attendees, some of the ideas that people gave me, and we followed up on them. So I'm always happy to hear from you. That's, we're here to service you, not so let us know. Okay, thank you again, Rabbi Doctor, and